You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
All right, guys, guess what? I have to interrupt because I am going to do an advertisement. We'll get right back to the show. I just have to talk about DraftKings.com. Fantasy baseball fans, on opening day, DraftKings.com awarded over $500,000 in cash prizes. See, it's one thing to play a game. It's another thing to play for cash. It's a lot more exciting, I think. All right? Now, you got to check out DraftKings.com. Okay, it's the one-day fantasy sports site, all right? And it is a fact that the listeners have won hundreds, thousands, even $1 million, not my listeners, but listeners in general, with DraftKings, okay? You watch sports and play fantasy, okay? This guy named Sam, don't know anything else about him, he won $100,000, apparently, his first time ever playing. So there is real money to be won. So here's the bottom line. Right now, you can play for free. You can win real cash. Enter Callen, C-A-L-L-E-N, today at DraftKings.com and get free entry into another huge contest. And they are awarding over $400,000 in cash prizes. $400,000. All right? That's what I make like a week. So that's a lot of money, guys. All right. Well, listen. Enter Callen now at DraftKings.com. All right? You get to play for free and win real cash. What more do you want from me? Oh, I know. The podcast. Let's get back to it, shall we? This is the Brian Callen Show, ladies and gentlemen, with Hunter Motz. Really, the Hunter Motz Brian Callen Show. Let's be honest, because Hunter's responsible for booking our, as usual, booking our next awesome guests. The authors of a book called "The Second Machine Age." It is. We have Eric Brynjolfsson on and Andrew McAfee. McAfee.
I love that you chose
my name. It's easier one.
But dude, it's usually McAfee, and now it's like you'd throw me for a loop. McAfee.
No, it's McAfee.
All right, thank you. Not spelled that way, by the way. M C A with a big A F E E, but that's okay. But I'm calling you McAfee from now on. I really loved your book, guys. I mean, it was great. Hunter and I had a long conversation about it yesterday, and. You know, when I was kind of psyched to get into it because I had read Ray Kurzweil's "The Singularity Is Near," which kind of blew my mind. You know, yep. And you guys spent a good long while talking to scientists and people on the cutting edge of all this technology. I would venture to say that you're pretty optimistic about the future.
Yeah, we are, and in particular. You know, Ray's book is called "The Singularity Is Near," but the time frames he's talking about there aren't actually all that near. You know, he's predicting somewhere around 2030, 2040, and Eric and I wanted to write about the years that are a lot closer, a lot more immediate, and to deal not only with the gee whiz science fiction innovation that we're seeing, but also with the economic consequences of it, both the really good news, because Eric and I are both optimists, and also some of the challenges.
That's what I loved about it. That's actually what I was going to say, is that it was way more practical. When Kurzweil's talking about, you know, nanobots in your body, okay, I get it, I know, and he's right, I'm sure, in 30 years. But what I really loved about the book, and especially later on, because I got kids in kindergarten, and I was thinking to myself, man, with how things are changing, you know, how the hell do I raise my kids? Well, the good news, by the way, was that I'm saving, you know, for their colleges and stuff, but I don't think they're going to need that much money for college. My feeling is by the time, you know, they're five, my daughter's five, my son's 2.5, by the time they're, you know, ready to go to college, I would imagine you can get a college education for $6,000, right? I mean, that seems to be where we're headed.
Well, yeah, I think that will absolutely be an option by then. There should be some serious alternatives to our home industry, which is higher education, which is currently very expensive, takes 4 years, sometimes does a great job of providing skills to people, sometimes does a not so great job. I would like to see a lot of disruption happening in my home industry and a lot of new options opening up. I think a lot of them facilitated by technology.
Yeah, that makes sense. And what I really liked also was the idea that though things are innovating very quickly, and you talk about Moore's Law and things, what I thought, something that was new to me, was the idea that innovation is the marriage between two already existing ideas. And that's happening at an exponential rate because people are able to talk to each other in real time, and it's so cheap. I mean, Skype is free. You've got scientists in India sharing ideas with scientists in Sweden, for God's sake.
That's exactly right. We call it combinatorial innovation. And what we're seeing is that every time somebody invents something, it doesn't use up the stock of inventions, and it doesn't make it harder to find new things. It makes it easier. That's why we're having 20-year-olds selling their companies for $2 billion this week. They're taking technologies that are already available, and they're recombining them in exciting new ways to create a ton of value. And then, when, as you say, you add another 5, 6, 7 billion brains to the process, you can't help but be optimistic about the potential going forward for a whole nother wave of innovations.
I think it's actually the thing that I am most optimistic about. The progress that Eric and I saw with robots and AI and machine learning and autonomous vehicles is mind-blowing, and it's great news. But, Brian, I'm actually more excited about the fact that in the next few years, not more than this decade, we're going to add literally billions of people to the world's community of potential innovators, of people who can access massive amounts of information, do very sophisticated analyses, contribute more to that information, and recombine stuff to come up with innovations. We put a quote in the book from the economist Julian Simon, who I think is really one of the most underappreciated thinkers of the 20th century, because he really had this fundamentally optimistic outlook because of, not despite population growth, but because of population growth.
I love that part of the book, by the way.
People solve people's problems.
Yes.
And if you
mm-hmm.
look at history, you come away believing that very, very deeply. So when I think about interconnecting all these people and letting them step on the gas pedal with innovation and problem solving, I try not to be a Pollyanna. I get really optimistic.
It got me excited. I mean, the idea that things are growing exponentially and it's getting cheaper. There is this true equality of consumption. There is a spread that you devote a chapter to, and the thing we have to worry about, which is that there are a lot of people, especially in the middle classes and things like tax lawyers, etc., and accountants, that might be left out of the mix, and that will pose its own challenges. But for the most part, there really is. A great deal to be optimistic about in terms of it being within all of our grasps to do things like communicate with each other over long distances for very free, to have virtual experiences, to be able to entertainment and ideas and be exposed to the best that's been thought and said or is being thought and said in real time. That way, the Khan Institute and all those things that you guys use all these great examples. It's really hard not to be super optimistic. But you also talk a little bit about the challenges and how, you know, there's a lot to be, you know, there are things to worry about. Talk a little bit about that.
And it's important to be balanced about that because, you know, you're absolutely right about the wondrous technologies, and it's showing up in some of the economic statistics. We're at record wealth, record productivity, record GDP, and that doesn't even count most of the free goods and services that are available on the internet. So that's the good news. But there is a paradox that really was part of what motivated us to write this book, that median income, the income of the person in the middle of the distribution today, is lower than it was in the 1990s. And the share of people working, the employment-to-population ratio, has also been falling. And that was happening even before the Great Recession. And that was kind of a puzzle to us. You know, how could this be that on one hand, we see with our own eyes these wondrous technologies, and a lot of the numbers are good, yet these other stats aren't so encouraging, and that affects a lot of people. And it turns out that the answer to both parts of that paradox is the same thing. The technology is creating wealth, but also it's simultaneously leaving a lot of people behind. There's no economic law that says that everybody's going to share equally when technology brings some of these wonders to the planet. It's quite possible for some people, even possible for a majority of people, to be made worse off in absolute terms. Now, to be clear, that's not something that happened for most of the past two centuries. By and large, it's been a rising tide that lifts all boats. But for the past about 15-plus years, there has been this decoupling. Andy and I call it the great decoupling of ever faster technological progress and productivity on one hand, and the average worker, the median worker, being left behind. We trace that to the inability of people's skills, organizations, institutions to keep up with ever faster technological growth.
And we hear a lot about the hollowing out of the middle class and the polarization of the economy. It turns out those just aren't bumper sticker slogans. Those things are really going on when you look at the evidence. And the research is mounting up that one of the main drivers of that is exactly this kind of technological progress. So absolutely globalization has been taking place, and that's a factor as well. But it looks like the biggest factor to date, and Eric and I believe the, by far the bigger factor going forward, is this relentless technological progress, which we are and should be really excited about, but that it's going to make it tough to earn anything like a good old-fashioned living for some types of people, and probably more types of people going forward. That's the challenge we have to confront.
Then again, you also talk about how you know it doesn't take that much effort to produce a whole lot for a lot of people. So
right.
It could be we just create this leisure class, and I'd like to sign up for that. I want to swill wine and wear tweed jackets and lie about celebrities
yeah.
I know.
And it can be all Downton Abbey all the time, right? But we had better make sure that we're preparing our society and preparing people for that kind of leisure class if that's where we think we're headed. Because when Eric and I looked at the evidence and looked at the research about what happens today when work leaves a community, unfortunately we don't see people just having these enlightened lives and debating democracy and philosophy and all that. These communities are really hurting in a lot of ways, and we need to do better.
Well, that's exactly it. Unemployment isn't exactly the same as leisure, and you're absolutely right. We can make the pie a lot bigger. We can create a lot of wealth, but we also have to think about who's going to participate that and how we can create shared prosperity.
I thought one of the most mind-blowing things that you said was that the effect of being unemployed for 6 months psychologically is the same as the
losing
death of a spouse.
That's a big, big deal. You know, we put a quote in the book from a guy who's employed in one of these allegedly inhuman Amazon warehouses, and we need to be very careful of whether we believe how inhuman these places are. But what he said really resonated with me. He said, look, work gives you your dignity back, and he was so grateful to have that job. Losing sight of that, the fact that you get a lot of your community and a lot of your inherent sense of self-worth and dignity comes from the good job that you do, we really don't want to lose sight of that. The other thing that was amazing to me, the stats that we came across that show that some important health measures are going in the wrong direction for lots of people. If you have below a high school education, your life expectancy is actually going down these days instead of up in America. You know, I can't tell a happy story about that.
Yeah. Yeah, well then, so, okay.
So how about this as a contrast? Like, paint for us what's the most dystopian future that you can imagine realistically, and what's the most utopian future if we do all the right things?
Well, yeah, and there's a whole range of possibilities, and it's quite possible to just let technology run on autopilot, and you get more and more concentration of wealth. You get not the 1%, but the 100th of 1% or less, really controlling all the wealth, all the assets, the superstars. And there's a lot to that when you have software eating an industry, it does tend to create these winner-take-all markets. And left to its own devices, you end up having a lot of other people not participating in that. But you could also imagine a future where we have, you know, Andy and I sometimes call it the digital Athens, the theory of the leisure class, where we have robot slaves providing the food, clothing, and other basic necessities
and sex,
for all of
and
us.
Sex, and sex. Don't be such
we didn't cover that.
I didn't say that.
Badly.
I know. Don't be such a prude, man. Come on. Jesus.
Whatever you need,
all your
basic functions that you need to be taken care of.
Yeah.
Well, you ask about the best and worst vision for the future. I think science fiction provides both extremes for us. My happy vision for the future is something like Star Trek, where we go around and, you know, boldly explore new worlds. And I never heard anyone on Star Trek complain about their paycheck. Their meals come out of some machine.
It's true.
They entertain themselves in the holodeck. You know, they probably take care of all the needs that you just identified in the holodeck. I don't know.
Yes, but do. If you're really familiar with the Star Trek canon, you'll know that's explored in Deep Space Nine.
Hunter has his hand down his pants as we speak.
Wow.
This is so weird.
Okay, but So that's the good vision. My dystopian vision is something like the Star Trek, the science fiction movie Elysium that came out last year, where literally the ultra-wealthy take themselves off the surface of the planet and build these beautiful ring worlds, while the rest of humanity is kind of miserable and fighting it out down there.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about the Kurzweil's, you know, book, and you hear this from a lot of scientists nowadays, at least computer scientists who are working on, you know, artificial brains and things. What happens when machines begin to not only mimic the human brain to the nth degree, when we reverse engineer the human brain, what happens when machines develop will and start producing machines smarter than they are? What happens? Are those machines going to have any respect for their biological heritage, i.e. human beings? Is that something that you guys worry about? I mean, is that a real fear that people are talking about, or is it just Kurzweil?
Or is it just the Terminator?
Yeah.
you know, we're not super worried about the Terminator scenario, but it's not something to be clear, it's not something we discuss a lot about in the book. We focus more on some of the economic implications.
Yeah.
That said, you know, I've spent enough time talking to some of the roboticists who are looking at that, and there are scenarios where we don't code the technology correctly, and it's not so much that there's free will and they decide that they want to wipe out humanity. The more likely disaster scenario is somebody just messes up in a big way, and just instead of, you know, bringing down the electric grid in the Northeast for a few hours or days, you know, something even more catastrophic happens that wipes out big chunks of humanity, or even all of humanity. That's not an impossibility. Those are some, you know, catastrophic scenarios that we probably should be paying some attention to. But our book is much more focused on the economic scenarios that are a little bit more in the next, say, 10 or 20 years.
Mm-hmm. The ground rule that I've absorbed when it comes to making predictions about technological progress is never say never. You get overtaken by events all the time. That said, the scenario that you guys outlined, this computers develop consciousness or a will and they turn against us, I haven't seen any evidence of that stuff cropping up yet. We haven't seen any trace of it appear, so it's not on my list of concerns for the short to medium term. I'm a lot more on the same page as Eric. Either inadvertent or deliberate bad catastrophic actions seem very, very plausible. There are viruses, there are system failures, cascading failures that can take out large amounts of our infrastructure. There are bad guys at work. You know, I'm sorry, but it really feels to me like it's only a matter of time until some group of bad guys fill up a drone full of explosives and fly it into something. I deeply wish that weren't the case, but that's the kind of thing that I can foresee pretty easily.
Yeah. Right.
Those are the concerns that I think we should be worried about.
Yeah,
or worse yet, to create some kind of self-replicating computer or biological virus, and you know, then they can do even bigger amounts of damage than explosives can, and those are things we're going to have to grapple with a lot more going forward. The technology is becoming more and more powerful. It's giving us the ability to shape the world much more than we used to be able to shape it,
and cheaper,
and that means individuals and small groups can do things that used to take nations. And, you know, a lot of that, most people use that for good, and most people use that to create a lot of wealth for others, and that's the good news. But we all know from history that not everybody behaves that way.
Well, that was one of the interesting things I thought that you did so well, is that as technology becomes more and more sophisticated, we have to become more sophisticated as human beings, because ultimately technology just magnifies whatever we are.
It also might mean we mesh with machines. I think that's more likely. I think that we will, you know, biocompatible, you know, body parts and even implants in our brain, et cetera. That is not far-fetched. That is
not anymore. It's already going on. We already have cochlear implants for our ears that give hearing back to the deaf. It's astonishing. The FDA approved the first retinal implants for use.
Yeah, Eric, you talked about that. What is that? Tell me about that.
It's a very low resolution screen right now that will put an image onto your optic nerve, just like a cochlear implant sends a pulse down your oral nerve.
Damn.
And if you haven't seen Hugh Hare's TED Talk, you got to watch that. Our colleague at the Media Lab, you know, he basically has bionic legs and walks around. You wouldn't know if he was wearing long pants that he actually, his biological legs aren't there anymore.
God.
And there's just a really, if you don't have a, if you're not crying by the end of his TED talk, then you probably have a bionic heart.
Wait, what's his name again?
His name is Hugh Herr, H-E-R-R, at the Media Lab. And he's building these bionic parts for disabled people, but also he talks about building them for people who aren't disabled and, you know, let you march for 40 miles if you need to do that without getting tired.
Yeah,
and
that
sounds
good.
And at the end of his TED talk, he brought out a young woman who was a dance teacher and got terribly wounded in the Boston Marathon bombing. And she came out with a bionic leg and danced, and there was not a dry eye in the house.
Oh, my God.
That was
God.
The first time she had danced since the marathon bombing.
Oh, yeah. It was awesome.
My God.
Well, and I was talking to you a little bit about this before we started recording, but what I love so much about this book, and Brian alluded this to, is that The Singularity Is Near is written for robots and technologists, and your book is written for human beings.
Yeah.
Like, it's like...
Yeah, it's so true, man.
You know, it's like, okay, how do I stay relevant in the economy? How do I make sure that my kids have a job?
Practical,
like,
shit.
Like, what is this going to feel like? Is this going to be dangerous? Like, how, as human beings, do we respond to this? And how do we use technology to magnify the best rather than the worst of humanity?
Yeah, and you talk about the Montessori schools, which I ran in. I was to my wife, I was like, check this out. There's a Montessori mafia, and now it turns out my son's actually going to Montessori, so that's good.
I'm the Montessori kid out of the two of us, so that makes
sense. There you go. Well, explain that to me. Why you explain why the Montessori program, and by the way, if Montessori then is the way to go for preschoolers, what do we do with kids who are, you know, what does that say about education going forward from there?
So let me talk about Montessori a little bit, and then I'll pass it over to Eric to talk more broadly about education. I was lucky enough to be a Montessori kid for preschool, for the very first years of my schooling. And what that educational philosophy teaches you, I believe, is that the world is a really, really interesting place, and your job, even as a little kid, is to go poke at it, is to go explore and learn and kind of do what you want to poke at the world, and by that process, you will educate yourself and you'll learn concepts like, like arithmetic, like math, like squares and cubes. That stuff will have come into you by osmosis, as opposed to being drilled into you while you sit in some desk, in some grid, in some small room in the same place every day. And I say that because when my school ended after the third grade, I had to go into the public school system. And it wasn't a terrible public school system, but I walked into the classroom as a, 9 or 10-year-old, and I said, are you messing with me? You want me to sit there all day, and this parade of topics is going to be inflicted on me by one person at the front of the room? And, you know, I thought I was on candid camera. It made no sense to me.
Right.
So the point that we were trying to make with the Montessori section is that there are these educational systems that seem to be doing a good job of fostering creativity and problem solving and curiosity, and a lot of the skills that Eric and I think people will need in the second machine age. I just have a little bit of firsthand experience with one of them.
But not just one of them, but far and away the most successful. I mean, Brian alluded to the Montessori Mafia, which you mentioned in the book, like Jimmy Wales, who started Wikipedia, Jeff Bezos, who started Amazon, you know, and then Larry Page, who's one of the two co-founders of Google.
God.
And, of course, also one of the authors of The Second Machine Age.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you. Include
Montessori
them. You include
school.
Ding, ding, ding. Yeah, thanks
ding,
for that.
There it is. Yeah, man. That gives me, you know, you got to...
I think that's the interesting thing about the Montessori schools is that what they recognize, which almost no other school system recognizes, is that emotions matter in the learning process. You know, the most schools just think, oh, you just need to keep inputting data into these kids.
Right.
You know what I mean? And eventually it'll stick. And what they don't realize is, no, learning is mediated by things like boredom, disinterest, actual hatred for the teacher or subject, you know? So, you know, you have to actually deal with the fact that we're human beings. We're not computers.
How is that going for us in this country? How is education changing, or are we still stuck in the orthodoxy?
This is a huge problem because for most of the 20th century, that has not been the model. It's been a model of, as Andy was saying, getting people to sit in rows and learn how to follow instructions. And I got to say, maybe that's what Henry Ford needed for his assembly line, and maybe that's what a lot of other businesses needed in the 20th century, the machine age that came before this one. But going forward, the kind of creativity that Andy was just talking about is much more at a premium. I mean, let's face it, machines are already pretty good at following instructions, and so we don't need more humans to learn how to do that quietly and passively. What we need is creative people. We also need people, by the way, to make emotional connections, to learn how to work in teams, to motivate each other, caring, nurturing. There are a whole lot of other things that humans can do exceptionally well compared to machines. Going forward, we have to have a fundamental reinvention of education. And sadly, it's one of the last industries to be reinvented. We've seen it happening in music and media and retailing and manufacturing and finance. It's finally beginning to happen in education, but it's been a long time coming. Ultimately, that's one of the other things that gives us a cause for optimism, is that there's so much room for improvement, frankly. Mm-hmm. And technology will be part of that too, by the way, not just the MOOCs and Khan Academy that bring some of the best materials to not just everyone in America, but everywhere in the world. A kid in Mongolia recently got the top score on in a 150,000 person circuits test at MIT and is now attending
so we
MIT
admitted
as
him.
A result.
That was amazing.
Yeah, so we admitted him. We said, hey, great, come on over here.
We're not stupid. We like talent too.
Yeah, you guys are out of MIT. Is that where you're?
We both got at MIT.
That's amazing.
There was also that great video that was floating around that internet about that kid in Africa who was using like spare parts to build, you know, his own like sound system or whatever, and you guys brought him over to MIT as well. I can't remember what the kid's name was.
But. Yeah, well, we try and be a magnet for those kinds of people. I mean, that's, you know, someone's got to do it, so we try to bring those geniuses from all over the world here, and it's gotten to be much more global, and it's great, and it goes in both directions with MITx. And our other programs, you know, people can take MIT courses anywhere in the world. That's part of the promise, and that's the part that gets a lot of attention. I want to say there's another part that's subtler, but I think ultimately will be even more important, and that is the way that when you digitize something, you also basically datafy it, to make up a word. You start getting data about what people are doing and how they're using it. And one of my colleagues who teaches a 100,000-person course said he was struck by how people were using the materials completely differently than he thought they were going to. Mm-hmm. They were doing the problem sets before listening to any of his lectures, and then going back and grabbing little bits of his lectures to solve, you know, the problems. It was a whole different, much more interactive learning style, and he hadn't known that until he looked at the data and looked at the different learning styles different individuals had. But ultimately, that allowed him to tailor the course and massively improve it going forward. And that's a small example of how you can kind of create a continuous learning process where you just keep making the materials better and better and more customized. And it can only be done if you have the data to understand what people are learning and how they're using it. So that's another thing that makes me optimistic.
In the education industry, there is no shortage of theories about how kids learn at all different levels and different styles for different topics and all of that. What Eric is saying is we can now test all those theories, not with tiny amounts of data, but with massive amounts of data. That should make us much better at teaching people.
Wow. And the question then is to get people to actually listen to the conclusions.
Yep.
That's it's a different mindset. You know, it's what Amazon has been doing, you know, on us when we go and they figure out how to fine-tune their recommendation engines. And they do 200 experiments a day at Amazon, okay? 200 per day.
What do you mean? So, what kind of experiments? Just all different?
Oh, you know, the little shopping cart, should it be on the left of the screen or should it be on the right of the screen? I mean, who knows? Who cares? You could hire a bunch of psychologists who would give you theories about why it's better to be on the left or the right. They say, forget that. Let's just run a test. And then by 5 o'clock that afternoon, they have enough data and they know that, oh, it turns out that it's better on the right. There's a 0.1% higher probability that you you complete your shopping experience. You know, problem solved. Let's go on to the next little experiment.
Hmm.
And that's what's so interesting, as you were talking about, you know, the MIT course being repurposed, is that, you know, ordinary people are problem solvers. They're innovators. They, you know, they want to create. They want to recombine. And so much, I think, of also what has to change is our conception of what a human being is. Because we've grown up in the era of the myth of the genius and that there are only certain very special people, as opposed to that we're all tinkerers. And if we all just tinker a lot, then we'll end up coming with amazing things that nobody would have ever imagined 20 years ago.
People are born that
way. Yeah, I
love
that idea, because we opened each of our chapters with quotes from smart people throughout history. And I think one of my favorites, which I hadn't come across before, was in the innovation chapter, and it's from Linus Pauling. And exactly as you just said, his quote was, "If you want to have good ideas, you have to have a lot of ideas."
Yeah. Well, I mean, I just from my own small perspective, just as a stand-up comic, you know, when you're coming up with like a 1 hour, like say I shot my special, now I'm about to shoot my next special, which means I got to come up with a whole new hour. The amount of stuff that you come up with that you throw away, that you try, that you practice, and then somehow if you keep doing it, it's somewhere along the line you start to develop some kind of a theme, or you start to realize, man, I've been writing about this idea this whole time subconsciously. But it really is a process of sort of, it is tinkering. It really is a process of rehearsal, reapproaching, trying this rhythm, trying that rhythm, taking these words out, scrapping that bit, you know, and re-asking the questions and coming up with different answers.
And you guys are a great example, because you go out there and you iterate and you experiment. You get rapid feedback from your audience
right away
every night.
Yes.
So you'll know if you're on a good trajectory or not. What Eric and I keep observing is too many businesses don't have that philosophy. They have this kind of moonshot idea, we're going to configure this thing perfectly, and when we turn it on, it's going to be beautiful. And that doesn't work. It doesn't work as well as an iterative approach.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's not the nature of innovation. And I think that's so much of when you were talking about, you know, that sort of idea of recombination, and that's how invention happens. I mean, I come from a biochemistry background, and it just sounds like evolution. Like it's an evolutionary process.
Yeah, you're right, man. I really think so too. Yeah. It's ugly.
So take that powerful force and apply it to ideas.
Yeah.
And better yet, have it work in 7 billion places in parallel and have people combine and recombine, and you're going to have a lot faster innovation.
So that's one of the interesting things. I think often you hear technologists tend to focus on rational processes, and they don't focus on psychological and emotional factors. And so there's often this fantasy among technologists that if we can just connect all the data in the world together, that like innovation will happen. And they don't understand that so much of this is mediated by cultural beliefs, what people believe is possible for them, whether they think that, you know, it's a moonshot process or they think it's a tinkering process. So, I mean, I think that's the thing, is part of how we ensure that we get that utopian Star Trek future rather than the dystopian Elysium future is we have to place a lot more emphasis on what people believe and think about themselves.
What Hunter said. Damn it, I wish I'd said that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Next time, write that down.
Sounds like a great speech there.
Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah. That's Hunter's.
I was standing on a rock when I said that.
Right. Hunter wrote a great book called The Straight-A Conspiracy, which is all about that. The art of learning and how, you know.
Look, Eric and I have spent just about our entire careers, both of us, at Harvard and MIT, so we are not averse to elite institutions at all. But I completely agree, Hunter, with what you were just saying, is we're going to make real progress when we open up this work of tinkering, experimentation, innovation, and improvement to lots and lots and lots more people, and not wait for the alleged smart guys in Cambridge, Mass, or Silicon Valley, or Washington, D.C. to lead us. It's just not the right way to think about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty, you know, listen, I'm just, it's so mind-blowing, but the only thing I think about is, as a human being, I'm always thinking about, you know, I want to be ready for when the shit hits the fan, and so that means, you know, most people, like, they'll store water and buy an arsenal. The truth is, you've got to be technologically savvy, you've just got to know, you've got to be meshed, you got to get more involved, not less involved. Those poor survivalists out there storing lentils and drums under the ground. Good luck. Good luck, man.
Yeah, but do you know what happens if you shove lentils into a computer? It breaks, Brian. So if the robots start coming at us, you just put some dry lentils in there.
I loved when that chess grandmaster said, how are you gonna prepare for this machine in your match? And he said, I'm going to bring a hammer.
Yeah. That's one of their favorite quotes that we come across. But also, chess teaches us something that blew me away when I learned about it, which is if you can combine computers and people properly, not only will you beat a grandmaster, not only will you beat the best chess supercomputer in the world, you'll also beat a grandmaster with a chess supercomputer. The winners of these freestyle tournaments planets are kind of mere mortal human chess players with fairly powerful computers, but they understand how to divvy up the work between human labor and digital labor, and they crush any flavor of competition.
That is a form of meshing with machines.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Right.
And isn't that so much of, you know, in terms of how do I stay employed over the rest of my career, so much of what you were saying, there was that great thing from Hal Varian where you were talking about the key is to basically figure out how to work with a computer and be extremely useful in that area.
Yeah, that's going to be the value going forward. And it's something we want to try and encourage more going forward, because a lot of the innovation that's happened over the past decade has been, you know, kind of simple-minded, substituting machines, substituting computers for human tasks, replacing a tax preparer with, you know, tax preparation software. And don't get me wrong, that's great. It creates a lot of value. It makes us wealthier collectively. But it also tends to concentrate the benefits in a much smaller group. You get these winner-take-all markets. And we'd love to encourage more entrepreneurship that, you know, we call it racing with machines, that figures out how to use technology to leverage people, to combine human and machine strengths to do something that neither one of them could have done previously.
You guys got to, I guess, get in there with gloves and move the way you wanted these robots to move on a factory floor. Didn't you do something like that?
We didn't need gloves. No. What was cool was with Baxter, it was designed to work right alongside humans. It's smart enough not to knock us over and take our heads off because it can see us and it's kind of gentle.
Wow.
But you're right. We didn't have to do any special programming. Even neophytes like me and Andy could walk in there, kind of grab Baxter's arm and gently guide it to say, pick this up and move it over here. And that is something that is revolutionizing the way robots work in factories.
This is actually a little bit of an embarrassing story. Like Eric says, the Baxter robot is designed to be trained, not programmed by a geek, but trained by a normal human being. And so we're getting introduced to Baxter, and the CEO of the company was showing us around, and then he got a phone call. So our buddy Rod Brooks had to go take the phone call, and he kind of left us alone with Baxter. And Eric and I looked at each other and said, all right, this is supposed to be easy to do. Let's train Baxter to do something simple. So we said to Baxter, hey, recognize this thing over here, and every time you see one, pick it up. And Baxter kind of said to us, okay. And so he did that, and then he just froze up and hung there. And Eric and I looked at each other and said, oh, man, you know, Baxter seems a little fragile. He's crashing kind of easily. And then Rodney came back over and said, what are you guys doing? We said, we're training Baxter. And he said, okay, you're training it to do a pick-and-place operation. You've done the pick. Have you told Baxter where you want him to place the object once he's done picking it up?
Yeah.
And we kind of said, no. And and Rod Brooks said, okay, you guys are incompetent at training this robot. Between us, Eric and I have, I think, 8 degrees from Harvard and MIT. We might have the wrong kind of expertise here.
That's so funny. What are your degrees? It's hilarious. That's a lot of degrees. That's it. That's pretty. You guys are good at math.
Brian and I have between us 2.
I have a BA in history from American University.
Right,
ladies
on.
And gentlemen. That's right. What are your degrees in?
My undergrad degrees are in humanities of all things from MIT. They just lump it all together and call it humanities. And mechanical engineering. I've got an MBA and a master's in mechanical engineering from MIT. And I did my doctorate at Harvard Business School.
I'm not unimpressed. I am not unimpressed with that.
Andy has more degrees than I do.
Andy?
I only have 3 degrees.
So. Poor guy. Yeah.
Poor guy.
Math,
3.
Decision science, and economics.
Yeah. Math, what else?
Decision science.
Sure. Yeah, I got that. Yeah,
Brian's made a decision before.
I couldn't decide what degree to get it. Yeah.
I can just see you guys coming to LA, just be invisible, like the smartest guys in the room, and nobody cares. What can you do for me?
Yeah, welcome to our lives.
Well, actually, this goes back to Brian and I yesterday. We're interviewing a fashion photographer, and you know, he like had on his phone just the most insanely hot women in the world.
Yeah,
and it's actually, I mean, it's
a black hole of
male attention. It would be really funny to give you guys that phone and just watch your IQ drop hundreds of points.
Well, because we're all biological, you know, as you were talking about the role that machines play, we still need soft, we need the things that we can't measure, wonder and humor and irony and touch and you know, flesh on flesh, et cetera, et cetera. We need that kind of stuff.
You guys seem a little obsessed, I gotta say.
Well, we're actually naked right now. So. The Second Machine Age is a very sexy book. But you guys are making a difference, man. It's really fun to read a book that puts all this stuff into perspective.
Yeah, and into a human perspective
Because it's really, with all this information, I mean, this podcast alone, as you read more and more, you know, we read all these books and we get people on who we think need a voice, need to be heard. But man, is there a lot of information out there. And one of the things I worry about is among my friends who are probably less educated, who didn't have the benefit of a formal education, whatever it might be, or just that base that you get. The internet can be a very destructive thing because there's so much misinformation, or at least information that is half baked, half true, catchy, and then they start to form their own web of
conspiracy theories.
And then
it gets weird, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, man. It's even the alternative health.
I got to say, you guys are extraordinarily well prepared for this interview. We've talked about the book with a lot of different people, and you sometimes get the impression that the person you're talking to hasn't read every word really thoroughly.
Now, we read the books. Yeah. We read the books because the reason we read the books is because if I'm going to have you on, the first thing I appreciate is anybody who writes a book. Because I know how, I've never written a book about Hunter has, but I just, as somebody who, you know, has written comedy specials and stuff, I know how much work it takes to kind of figure out, first of all, and you talk about this in the book, what are you trying to say? First of all, what are you trying to say?
Yep.
And that hasn't been said. And when you do that as well as you guys have done that, that needs to be heard. I mean, Hunter and I were literally talking about pairing guys like you up with like a celebrity. And just so people would tune in. Yeah, just so people would tune in to hear what Zach Galifianakis' point of view would be on this book. Because
that would be ugly.
Right, exactly.
I think the president did an amazing job of holding his own with that guy.
He really did. He was great. He was great. But, you know, that's the idea, because I think, you know, Hunter and I are not making money on this. It's not like we're going to get rich on this podcast. But what's fun is that
It's
fun to be naked. And it's fun to kind of, you know, you get guys out there who basically are answering questions and raising questions that need to be answered. And so let me piggyback on that comment. What makes you guys mad or worried about the current state of the world? And if I were to make you emperors, what would you do to change that?
Well, certainly, we're not unique in this. The most depressing part of this whole story is what's happening in Washington and the political system in general. Mm. We can't help but be amazed when we come back from Silicon Valley, or even just when we walk across campus and talk to our friends in the Media Lab and CSAIL, and just there's so much innovation happening in technology really all over the world. But something we've learned from our research is that technology by itself can only get you so far. You have to have the complementary organizations, skills, and institutions. We made huge changes in America in the 1800s and 1900s, from mass public education to changes in organization and tax policy that allowed us to take those technologies and create shared prosperity. Today, we've got one of the most dysfunctional governments that I've ever seen, and it's not keeping up with technology, I don't see the conversation really being where it needs to be. It's really mired in a lot of irrelevancy. We're hoping that this book would help change that conversation and get people focused on the big forces. And the disruption that we've seen in the past 10 years, by the way, is just a small forbearance of the even bigger changes we're going to see in the next 10 years.
It's batting practice compared to what's coming up.
What do you mean?
I mean, when Eric and I look at the kinds of innovation, the kinds of things that we're seeing, all the geeks that we talk to say, "Oh no, we're not done. We're just getting warmed up." So, you know, you take autonomous vehicles, and you take drone delivery, and you take machine learning and artificial intelligence and networked innovation and crowdsourcing and robots, and you combine all those things, and then it keeps getting cheaper all the time to do these things.
Yeah.
You know, good heavens, I want to be clear. We don't know what's coming exactly.
Right.
Anyone who does think that they know it will tell you that they know what's coming is lying to themselves or lying to you. The next decade is going to see crazy innovation.
Well, by the way, as you talk, I'm not so sure we do need Washington. I'm not so sure we need the federal government to be involved in any of that stuff. We seem to be doing just fine without it. I mean, you do. I think there is a role for intelligence agencies to monitor to an extent some of this technology to make sure that somebody doesn't use it for, you know, bad purposes. But and that's a whole different conversation.
Yeah, but is the federal government effective at doing that?
Well, yeah, but you guys are bringing up a really fundamental point, and you ask what would happen if, you know, they made me and Eric co-emperors for a day and we could wave our magic wand and enact changes. But I think the ones that we would enact are really straightforward, and they have to do exactly as you guys are saying, not with some big centralized Stalinist economy where Washington knows what's best for you, but with creating an economic environment that will let what America is good at happen. And we're not doing a terribly good job of creating that economic environment. So in the book, we talk about just the Econ 101 playbook to underscore how unprovocative these ideas are among economists. And they have to do with things like upgrading our infrastructure, so it's not a kind of a running joke among countries. Making sure we get our immigration policies right, creating a good environment for entrepreneurship, revamping our educational system, and funding basic original research. If we did these things correctly, man, we would step on the gas pedal. And I'm not saying things would be magically great, but they would be a lot better than they are now. What's frustrating to us is that we're not following just the basic Econ 101 playbook very well right now.
Why are we not doing that?
You know, as Eric says, there's gridlock going on. There's really intense partisan debate and bickering about the validity of that playbook. The point we try to make in the book, though, is that when you go talk to professional economists, and economists have a wide range of political leanings, when you go talk to professional economists and bring up our Econ 101 playbook, you can't start a fight. You really can't have a debate. The consensus is just huge.
Really? Wow.
Well, I mean, and that's, yeah, you cite, I mean, I thought the thing that was most telling was when you take Mankiw's book, and then I can't remember who, Mankiw is conservative. I mean, if you could lay out for our listeners that comparison between essentially the right-leaning book and the left-leaning book.
Sure, absolutely. You know, Greg Mankiw was chairman of George Bush's Council of Economic Advisors. You take Joe Stiglitz or Paul Krugman, who are on the left. That set of policies that Andy just mentioned would appear in either one of them. And more broadly, if you want to be more radical about some of the things we talked about, negative income tax, that was something, an idea that was pioneered by Milton Friedman, that noted socialist.
Free to choose, so, baby.
Yeah.
So you get people across the aisle interested in a lot of the same kinds of policies, but the conversation in Washington is totally kind of off the rails on a whole different set of issues. And we hope that this book will help bring people back to understanding these much more really tectonic forces that are changing the economy and the importance of getting back to some economic fundamentals that I think, you know, there's widespread agreement on, but we're just not discussing them. Ultimately, I think that the way to change that conversation is not starting with Washington. As you say, it's got to start in the rest of the country. And to some extent, you can invent around Washington, you can work around it. But also, I think as more people, you know, understand the issues, they'll start putting pressure on their congressmen to do the right thing.
Well, I think the other thing is, I mean, Brian and I are both huge, huge fans of Lawrence Lessig's book, Republic Lost.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, I think...
I mean, Larry's great. He gave a TED Talk again this year. You know, we had to go up and give him some love afterward. He just does great work.
Yeah, he does.
And I mean, that's the thing. I think so much of the, you know, as we read all these books and talk to authors like you, the recurring theme is always people respond to incentives. And the problem in Washington is that the incentives that we've set up are campaign finance. And that encourages bickering because you have to pretend like the world is about to end and the other people are the devil because otherwise, I mean, like, I'm really getting sick of, I don't even know how I got on the Barack Obama mailing list. But like every day, like many, many times a day, they're telling me that if I don't send them $5, you know,
they're going to shoot this puppy, right?
That's right.
The puppy will die.
Exactly. Like the world will stop spinning and, you know, we'll be in one of those movies like 2012 or whatever it was and the world will freeze and, you know,
yeah,
it's amazing.
The movie's Frozen. Yeah. The movie you're talking about is Frozen.
No, Brian.
My daughter's
just,
watching 17.
Exactly.
My daughter sings that song, and not if she's not going to be a singer.
You know, so Eric and I are dismayed by that same thing. At the same time, though, and again, I don't want to be a Pollyanna, but there are some hopeful signs out there. For example, comprehensive immigration reform came kind of close to passing. Mm-hmm. The American people support it. The Senate has passed it. We might actually get there, and that would be a big deal. And more fundamentally, 10 years ago, if somebody had said to me that we would have marriage equality and legal marijuana widely in America.
Yeah, you're right.
I would have laughed them out of the room. It was a joke.
I know.
But what happened in both those cases is the conversation changed, and our leaders eventually responded to it.
Well, that is where I find, and I think that you bring this up in the book, you know, the ideas are very powerful, right?
Yeah.
The way to beat a bad idea is with a good idea. And now we are living in a world where you can really share ideas very quickly. And if it's a good idea, man, it's like this book, for example, it's really hard to refute if you are somebody of just common sense. You don't have to be that educated. When these issues are explained the way you guys explain them and you highlight the challenges, when people are sharing these ideas, I feel like that is reason to be very optimistic, because for the first time in our history, somebody who has an idea in India, they can give a TED talk, etc., and we're all talking about it immediately afterwards.
Yeah, and it will go global. Or, you know, to take a more parochial example, a couple of dweebs from MIT can write a book, and a stand-up comedian in L.A. will want to talk to them.
Stand-up comedian / actor. I mean, I don't know if you saw Ride Along or The Hangover, but let's – come on, guys.
And The Hangover, too.
Thank you. Yeah. The Hangovers. Keep going. Yeah. No, listen, man, you guys, it's a privilege for me to get to talk to guys like you. You know, I'm around actors and comedians, and for me to be around two guys who have 8 degrees or 7 degrees among them from Harvard and MIT, you know, usually I wouldn't get a chance to talk to you guys for an hour.
So. No, the pleasures are, we really are grateful that you're helping to change the conversation out there, because like we're saying, this, you know, whether it's the Tea Party or Occupy Wall Street, there's a lot of people who are angry, but I think their anger is misfocused at, you know, evildoers here and there. When if they understood the bigger forces that are going on, I think we could make a lot more constructive progress. And you guys are doing a lot to help change that conversation. So we're grateful to you for helping us.
Voice. It's a pleasure. You know, Lawrence Lessig's book, he opens with, I think it was Thoreau's quote, "I see men everywhere hacking at the branches of evil while none are hitting the root."
Right.
You've got to know. Yeah, it's one thing to say something is evil or something is bad. You've got to know what kind of bad, what kind of evil. You've got to know where to swing at, otherwise you're shadow boxing. You know, you got to know where you what to punch, you know.
Well, if we can help, that's, you know, would be our job here at MIT, is to try to understand those forces, and then you can help spread the word.
Well, Eric Brynjolfsson, Yulefson, and Andrew McAfee, spelled McAfee,
yeah,
but he needs to be difficult on this show.
Will these digital implants allow Brian to pronounce names?
No, that's not realistic.
Not realistic, okay. Man.
Well, because John Travolta could also use one of those.
That was the funniest thing I've ever seen. The book is called The Second Machine Age. You guys did a great job. It's also on audio, and I always tell people, man, listen to a book. If you listen to a
book,
it's
better than reading. Although I will say, whoever reads your audiobook sounds a lot like Matt Stone and Trey Parker. So I kind of felt like I was getting amazing insight into the future from South Park.
Yes, wasn't he dramatic?
Yeah.
I listened to part of it, and I was like, wow, that's really exciting.
Yeah,
his name is Jeff Cummings. I love it.
Yeah.
With the traffic you guys have in L.A., audiobooks are probably a great innovation.
They are amazing.
They're amazing. And if you want me to read your next book, I'll read it this way, in an aristocratic accent.
I'm now
the Second Machine Age Part 2.
The Third Machine Age.
But you're going to have to compete with Siri, though.
Well, that's fine. Yeah, well, she got a high voice. I have a deep English voice. Eric Brynjolfsson and Andrew McAfee. But he says McAfee.
Can you get your good, close, personal friend, Scarlett Johansson, to read our next audiobook?
Yeah, I think you're right. That's the voice we need.
Hey, listen, boys, whatever you need, huh? You guys have big brains. I'll let her know.
We appreciate that.
You guys are great, man. Listen, if you're in Boston, I'm not sure when I'll be doing stand up next up there, but I'll let you know when I'm bringing my show.
Please do. It would be great.
We'll bring
love
a posse.
That.
I'd love it. I'll let you guys know.
And until then, you can just rewatch again and again that scene in Hangover 2 that Brian's in. It's a few minutes long, just put it on
loop.
Or
watch my special man class. You'll learn nothing at all, but you might get a couple laughs. Hey, guys, we really appreciate it, man. Thanks so much for your time.
It's an absolute pleasure. Thank you for having us.
All right, man. Well done, and keep making the world a better place.
You too. Thanks. Keep it up.
Later.
Thank you. Bye. Thanks.
Amazing.
Yeah, it was awesome.
I mean, like, what great guys.
It's so fun to talk to people that smart and who are just really they seem like really down-to-earth normal guys.
Yeah, you could totally hang out with them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there it is, ladies and gentlemen. The second machine age, work, progress, and prosperity in a time of brilliant technologies. It was a really good book. So,
and listen, I mean, you know, Brian and I were talking about this the other day with Dove Davidoff, who is in the studio.
Hey!
But I mean, you know, so much of the fun of reading books is being able to like pull out ideas or cool anecdotes or any of that sort of stuff. And if you want to impress people at a party, then just read this book. Because it'll give you great things to drop on
people.
Something
else to keep in mind, guys, is, you know, it seems like educating yourself and becoming an educated person seems like such a difficult task. What's interesting is the more you read, the more you realize that there aren't that many new ideas out there. You can really develop a base for the big ideas pretty quickly. And then from there, you know, if you know the people that really made the difference, if you know sort of like what the big ideas were that kind of sparked all the other ideas, you know, it's just called building a base. And once you build that base, it's so much easier to absorb other information.
That's absolutely true. I mean, that's the thing. People remember things because they have context for them.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, that's whether this is language learning, like if you speak a language like English, and then, which presumably you do if you're listening to this podcast, if you don't listen to English, if you don't speak English, then maybe this isn't
the
podcast.
Can I be honest with you? A lot of people from other countries love the sound of my voice. It's very soothing.
And they just don't even know
what
you're saying.
Well, they play it for their pets and their babies.
And their plants, so their plants can grow.
When they want their plants to grow or their babies to sleep.
Yeah.
They play this voice.
But the more you know about something, the easier it becomes to learn about other things.
That's right.
So,
that's right.
You know.
That's right. All right, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you learned everything. This is Hunter Motz and Brian Callen signing off.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.